The latest inflation numbers barely edge downwards, meaning that the average American is now suffering from both economic and political instability. Mass layoffs, which had been delayed until after the election, have already started as the world keeps moving forward, even if America's electoral results do not. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The EU's executive arm, the European Commission, suggests the bloc's economy will have contracted for a six-month period up to the end of March 2023. This means recession. Inflation is forecast to stay high for longer than initially anticipated. Uncertainty surrounds the medium to long-term picture also.
The largest threat comes from adverse developments on the gas market and the risk of shortages, especially not this winter but next winter.
As EU energy sanctions against Russia appear to backfire, business and consumer confidence continues to decline across the 27-country bloc.
We're very concerned, particularly for people that are on lower incomes that are very much affected by the higher energy prices.
I'm afraid that it can get much worse before it gets better.
The price of the energy is so high. The price of the products, I think it's a thing of everything.
EU leaders firmly blame Moscow for the crisis amid the conflict in Ukraine. However, some commentators claim the United States has used NATO to manufacture the war.
America is fighting against multilateral world, but basically is fighting against our freedoms, our democracy, and everything it pretends it stands for.
The EU says it will continue to fund the Ukrainian army and government no matter what the cost. Back home, the only good news is that employment figures remain positive. Just modest damage to the EU labour market is forecast for 2023. It is an area that is being monitored very closely by the Commission, as there's broad consensus. A sharp rise in unemployment would represent the final nail in the coffin for the EU economy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Diplomatic tension between Italy and France keeps mounting as the French NGO-run search and rescue ship Ocean Viking reached the French port of Toulon with its load of 234 asylum seekers on Friday. The ship had been refused a port of safety by Italy's far-right government for around 3 weeks, a decision that the French government slammed as irresponsible and inhumane. In response to the situation, Paris suspended plans to take in 3,500 refugees currently in Italy, calling on all the countries in the EU's migrant relocation mechanism to adopt similar measures.
È la prima nave.
The Ocean Viking, NGO ship that docks in France today, is the first NGO ship to have ever docked in France, and it has 234 migrants. This generated a very tough reaction with respect to Italy, which has allowed almost 90,000 immigrants to enter since the start of the year. 90,000! All NGO ships dock in Italy. What makes us angry? That Italy has to be the only country to provide a disembarkation port. This is not written in any agreement. France's response was aggressive and unjustified.
A third of the 234 asylum seekers on board the NGO ship will be relocated in France, while 4 passengers with serious health difficulties were transferred to a French hospital. This is not the first diplomatic rift between Italy and France in recent years. In 2019, Paris recalled its ambassador to Rome for consultations after then Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio urged members of the Yellow Vest movement to continue with a protest against the French government.
There is a clear resemblance between the rift that took place in 2019 and the present one. Both cases are just a mere provocation on the part of nationalist, populist Italian executives. This tension between Italy and France is the result of the insubstantiality of the EU's migration policy.
While EU countries keep failing to collectively assume responsibility on the migrant issue, around 20,000 asylum seekers have died trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea since 2014, while tens of thousands are stuck in Libyan detention centers where torture, sexual violence and abuse are rife. Max Civili, Rome.
Walthamstow, a town in East London, home to more than 150,000 people and the longest outdoor market in Europe.
It also happens to be one of the poorest areas, where a national cost of living crisis is pushing more and more people to the brink. And less money in people's pockets has meant less business for the shops and stalls here.
Couple that with soaring utility bills and increased prices that make running a successful business a real challenge.
My weekly sale is like half and half now, this time especially. For example, I'm earning about a weekly 1,000. For example, it's go 5. It's half and half now. And the people are scary. They don't spend much. They are very choosy now.
Quiet, very quiet. We see the market empty. Because we have people, but like pass, just on the pass. Nobody do shop because they don't have money. But rent now high. But energy right now very, very high. Gas high. And because that expensive right now.
The cost of living crisis has fed into the housing market as well, forcing Anne, who works in a coffee shop, to move house.
A couple months ago, I was living in a house share, but the landlord got really, like, worried about the cost of living, and he, like, tried so hard to, like, increase the prices little by little, and we ended up, like, having an argument about it, and he ended up, like, evicting me because, like, I didn't think it was fair, but he was forcing us to do stuff. So now, like, I'm paying, like, a really high price for, like, such a small room, no, like, living room or anything.
More than 6,000 people in this area claim universal credit. Recent surveys have found that nearly half of the children here live in poverty. Desperate parents and households are having to rely on charities such as this one to get by. We were told the Roxana Khan Foundation Food Bank gives donations to an increasing 300 households every week. Inflation remains stubbornly in the double digits. The government has hinted at increased taxes and cuts to public spending. Many here and across the UK will find it even more difficult to make ends meet. Saeed Puriza, Walthamstow, East London.
A recent study published in the Indian Journal of Ophthalmology reveals that a large number of those who sustained eye injuries due to the use of pellet guns in the mainstay of Srinagar between July and November 2016 have suffered some degree of vision loss. The survey conducted on 777 eye operations during the period reveals 80% of the victims have vision limited to counting fingers. 35-year-old Arshid Ahmed, a student of arts, was hit by pellets in both eyes in October 2016. 6 years on, Arshid says his vision of higher studies diminished just like his eyesight.
Initially, I thought things might get better after the operation, but as time passed, it started to get worse. The most hurtful thing for me is that I am dependent. I feel I'm a burden. How long will my family be able to support me?
Arshid's family was more fearful than hesitant to talk, and convincing Arshid to speak to Press TV about his condition was no less than a Herculean task.
I'm often confined to my room. Darkness is my future, although the government has bragged about rehabilitation and support for pellet victims. We're left to helplessness and nothing else, and speaking about my helplessness has now become a crime.
Before the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in 2019, New Delhi used shotguns for almost a decade to quell anti-India demonstrations in Indian-administered Kashmir, resulting in thousands of pellet injuries and the epidemic of vision loss in the region. Following the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, people here might be upset about many things changing in the region. However, a remarkable achievement for government forces is that not even a single pellet gun has been used in the region following a tough crackdown on protesters. Kashmir has been a bone of contention between India and Pakistan for decades. Both lay claims to the region, but rule it in parts.
India regards Kashmir as an integral part of its territory. Meanwhile, analysts say since the abrogation of Kashmir's special status, New Delhi seems to own everything in Kashmir except the problems of its people. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The largest ever joint U.S.-South Korea Air Force drills extended into last weekend as North Korea launched more missiles. Pyongyang argues U.S.-led military exercises revived this year are a rehearsal for invasion. Amid reports North Korea may conduct a seventh nuclear test, U.S. officials warned Pyongyang the use of nuclear weapons would end its regime. In South Korea Thursday night, university peace activists gathered for a vigil outside the U.S. embassy, calling for an end to the U.S.-South Korea-Japan alliance and removal of President Yoon. The U.S. has also conducted renewed joint drills with Japan, including a naval fleet review as Tokyo seeks to normalize its military activities.
North Korea faces much stronger conventional forces in the U.S.-South Korea alliance, which is at least partly why it showcases its missile and nuclear deterrence. With the U.S., South Korea, and Japan all bolstering their weapons and military drills, the questions are if and when North Korea will conduct a seventh nuclear test. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Ongoing Israeli military raids to the occupied West Bank areas continue under different pretexts. Early on Wednesday, regime forces raided Balata refugee camp in Nablus, killing Palestinian teenager Mehdi Hashash and seriously wounding several others. Dozens more Palestinians suffered suffocation due to tear gas inhalation.
Their main program is ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And the second is to suppress any form of resistance of Palestinian people and to enhance settlements everywhere. So practically, Israel has all the interest in enhancing the oppression against Palestinians. And we've seen even certain escalation during election time because Israeli parties were using Palestinian blood to feed their election purposes.
The Israeli military said it carried out the attack to secure a visit by settlers and members of the Israeli parliament from the Likud party to Joseph Stump, located near Balata refugee camp. The military said in a statement that the Palestinian gunmen fired in the direction of a convoy carrying the party members. The attack comes as the Israeli Knesset members are celebrating the victory of Benjamin Netanyahu's bloc, the Likud, in the recent elections.
Over the last 7 years, we have been resisting the Israeli aggression. We have witnessed escalation of tensions, while calm has prevailed on some occasions. But the current transitional cabinet in Israel needs to prove that it's a right-wing cabinet. I think with the recent escalation of violence against Palestinians, we might witness a real third intifada.
In addition to the military raid to Nablus, Israeli forces stormed Ramallah, Bethlehem, and Al-Khalil. Regime forces arrested over a dozen Palestinians, accusing them of carrying out terrorist acts. Palestinians who have been confronting Israeli military raids warn such crimes and escalation could at the end of the day set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Addressing world leaders at the climate summit in Egypt, UN Chief Antonio Guterres says it's a moral imperative for rich countries to help vulnerable countries. Regarding that, the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Taliban emphasizes that climate change does not know political borders, and countries which have no role in creating climate crisis have suffered the most damage and should not be ignored.
In recent 4 months, we have witnessed a significant rise in the number of natural disasters in Afghanistan. They include earthquake, flash flood, and drought. According to our assessments, almost 10 million people affected by these disasters need urgent help. We also need international cooperation to deal with impacts of such crises.
Afghanistan emits almost 0.1% of global greenhouse gases. But it is paying the price for growing climate chaos, mostly created by top emitters in the world. The results of climate change, including earthquakes, flash floods and drought in Afghanistan, drive people towards hunger day by day. OCHA says 97% of Afghans could be too poor to survive without aid by the end of this winter, which shows a 50% rise in 2 years.
I would say 70% of people can't afford their basic needs. People have become poor. It has become much more difficult for many Afghans to buy food. And by winter, the situation would even get worse, I believe.
Previously, we had jobs and we could save for our winter. But now, I work only one day in a 10-day period. Some nights, we only eat bread with tea. We could use the aids if there were any.
According to the United Nations, Afghanistan is the sixth most affected country in the world, enduring the consequences of climate change. Immigration, job losses and cropland destruction are the results of climate change. These problems are aggravated by recent political conflicts and severely impact the country's economy. The devastating results of climate change have added to the problems Afghans are facing. International help for this winter could ease the situation for people already grappling with poverty. Abdullah Emirzadeh, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among thy troops are the victors, and place me in thy party, for thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among thy friends, for thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
North Korea has been on a missile launch run lately. In one day, it tested fire 25 missiles. Why has North Korea been so aggressive when it comes to these launches? Is it to grab attention from the U.S.? Yet when it comes to North Korea, the U.S. President Joe Biden says the U.S., Japan, and South Korea are more aligned than ever on North Korea. Shouldn't they try to be more aligned with North Korea itself instead of among themselves, or at least with China? Just a few of the questions we'll be asking from our guests in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Mike Billington, Asia editor at the Executive Intelligence Review, joins us from Hamilton, Virginia. Also joining us is Arnold August. He's an author and journalist who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both, gentlemen. Mike Billington, I'll start with you. The amount of missiles that North Korea has launched is, in a sense, incredible. And one day, 25 missile tests were conducted. Why do you think that they feel that they have to launch so many missiles? What are they trying to say here?
Well, the obvious is that they're trying to demonstrate that they have the capacity to defend themselves and that they're willing to do so by attacking any source of attack from outside their borders. There may very well be other justifications which they have not made public.
Okay. Arnold August, let me ask you, in terms of the way that they have done this, analysts are saying that this is perhaps building to something bigger, like maybe a nuclear test, which the U.S. is anticipating, or a full long-range ballistic missile test out to be conducted to the Pacific, or both. Do you think that that is what North Korea is intending to do?
I think one has to look at North Korea similar to what Mike just mentioned, from their own point of view, their own standpoint. It is quite obvious for some time, I would say, since the last meeting of the big powers in Madrid, NATO, last June, for the first time, NATO and the West specifically mentioned that, yes, we're concerned about Russia, but our main fear is is China. And then, of course, you had the very well orchestrated and deliberate sending by the Biden administration, Nancy Pelosi, to Taiwan. And since then, it's been escalating. Now, in that context, I think that North Korea has every right to have nuclear weapons to defend themselves. One could just imagine if they did not have these weapons to defend themselves against states, it's quite possible that North Korea would have been overthrown by this time. Let us take the example, if I'm not mistaken, Gaddafi, he gave up on the issue of nuclear weapons. What happened after that? The United States invaded the country, killed the legitimate leader of that country in Libya, and has been going downhill since. So I think people are perhaps have to learn from history and put things into context and not allow the mainstream media to focus, North Korea, they're bad. They tested missiles, but what is the context?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you can tell us, Mike Billington, whether these missile tests, along with the military exercises that the U.S. has conducted, whether it's with South Korea or with Japan, and also how it has been provoking China, such as providing, for example, Taiwan with arms, is all related, in a sense, to the way that North Korea has exercised these vast numbers of missile tests. I mean, are these things related?
Well, you know, everything is related in terms of the development of human history. The current global showdown, the global crisis being orchestrated virtually every day over many different aspects of the unfolding of history, the evolution of what has become a very near-term degeneration into global nuclear war centered around the Ukraine crisis. All these things are related. I think you really have to step back from the strategic nuclear confrontation, military threats, and so forth. It's required that you look at the global emergence of history as a from a single perspective in order to have a sense of what is going on in front of our eyes and what is rapidly escalating crisis situation that could become a war virtually overnight by intent or by mistake. That's the point of initiation of looking at this descent to a nuclear war. But on the other hand, you also have to have a broader perspective and recognizing that the Western financial system is disintegrating. We're sitting on top of the greatest explosion of the dollar-based Western financial system in history. And it's this that's driving the war rather than the other way around. The feeble and ridiculous effort by some of the Western financial moguls to say that the current Western financial disintegration is being brought about by Russia's taking its oil and, and gas off the markets is totally absurd, first of all. It's not Russia that took its oil and gas off the markets. But it also is trying to separate the energy crisis and the general economic breakdown crisis in the West from its reality, which is 30, 40 years of crazy speculative printing of money, dollars and other currencies.
Let's take a look at what Russia has said, actually, since you've mentioned Russia over here. Arnold August, Russian foreign minister, has said that the U.S. and NATO are militarizing the Southeast Asia region in order to contain the interests of Russia and China in the Asia-Pacific. Now, I'm looking at that statement coming from the Russian foreign minister, and I'm asking you to whether you can put that into context for us when it comes to the way that actually the U.S., has said that both Russia and China can exercise their influence on North Korea. You know, you have the U.S. on the one hand that obviously is not on good terms with Russia, nor with China, really, in a sense, accusing them of a variety and a host of issues, but yet they want to ask them to leverage their influence over North Korea. I mean, isn't that like having the cake and eat it too type approach by the U.S.?
Yes, it is. And I'd like to just add to that one point. Mike also said the necessity to look at the overall context and to dot the lines, dot the I's. So I would say, you know, we're looking at what region? It's a South China Sea. What is the key country in the South China Sea? There's only one, the People's Republic of China. And so, in my view, if you want to look into the context, the current offensive by the United States and its allies, including Canada and Europe, began, say, in 2014 in Russia when NATO launched its offensive to push Russia to the brink, where it had no choice to defend itself against NATO incursions right on the border of Russia. And I have said that before, and I'll say it again. While it is obvious the main target of NATO and Western countries is Russia, but the ultimate goal of these countries is to weaken Russia, not just as a phenomenon as such, but as part of the growing alliance between Russia and China, which also includes many other countries, such as BRICS, which is exploding. Every time we have an interview here on Press TV, we talk about the number of countries that are joining BRICS. Well, since the last conference here, there's been several other countries joining. So my view is that everything that's happening, whether it's in Eastern Europe or in the South China Sea, the main target is China. And I would not say just to contain China, as the United States puts it diplomatically, but the United States is not interested in containing anything. Right from this very beginning, the United States wants to control completely the countries of the world that they want to dominate. And those countries that stand up to U.S. domination, whether the United States admits it or not, the ultimate goal is regime change. Their goal in Russia is regime change. They want to get Putin out in order to have a government that is compliant with the United States. And the same thing goes, it's hard for them to talk about regime change and China, forget about it, but they're going to try everything to destabilize China and make it difficult for it to continue on the path of major economic developments that the whole world can now see.
Well, the U.S. is benefiting from this, though, in some sense, Mike Billington, if you agree. I mean, at this point, you had this massive war games that the U.S. conducted with Japan. Japan is now intimidated, and it wants, next month, it has announced that the government is going to double the defense budget over the next decade, and it's going to acquire long-range strike weapons. And, of course, that's going to come from the U.S. Do you think that that is obviously one intention the U.S. has when it comes to North Korea vis-a-vis militarizing that region?
Yes, I think the answer is yes. The Western financial system is in a state of total bankruptcy, which is increasingly recognized around the world, and that there's no easy fix, no solution to the bankruptcy. And therefore, many in the West, the so-called war party, which includes people from all the political parties in the U.S., both the Republicans and Democrats, who believe that pushing for war is the only way to start the money pumping for the military-industrial complex, as well as the interplay between the national financial institutions in Europe, in the U.S., in developing sector, the South American banking interests, the African financial institutions, and so forth. So in that sense, yes, the diverting of funds to the money trading centers in the financial institutions, the hedge funds and the and other aspects of this, but in particular those that are tied to financing this war, which is, you know, demanding the printing of billions and billions, trillions even, of new credit being pumped out into the system. This is all interfaced. The Wall Street financier crowd and those who are making sure politically as well as financially that new credits are being issued regularly to finance the military industrial complex. All of that is being waged full steam.
Okay. All right. So, you know, while Mike Billington was speaking there, Arnold August, I couldn't help but try to draw a comparison here, which I don't know if it's appropriate or not. So I'm going to ask you, when you take a look at the way that the U.S. is militarizing the region, we're looking at obviously some of the countries in particular like South Korea and Japan. It kind of looks like what it's doing in the area where Ukraine is. You know, you have all these NATO countries, and they're all being pumped with lots of weapons, with the threat being Russia. And here you have the threat being North Korea, and they seem to be ramping up that kind of approach. And interestingly, reports are suggesting that Japan is negotiating the purchase of these Tomahawk cruise missiles, which has the ability to strike targets deep inside China. So that seems to be in line with what they're doing in the Ukraine area. Is that an appropriate comparison?
I think it's more than appropriate, because what we're seeing now over the last few weeks, few days, is a NATO-style aggression led by the United States and their allies such as Canada and Europe against China. There's no doubt about it. With Taiwan, I guess one could say the proxy in this case is Taiwan, as Ukraine is the proxy against Russia in Eastern Europe. And I think it's important to analyze the fact it was raised by Mike and yourself, like the whole issue of a currency that is outside of the control of the United States and Europe and Canada. This is a major breakthrough, a major project that is going on right as we speak. That's why I have to mention BRICS once again, that is burgeoning. And the main feature of BRICS, it has already started, and that is using currencies that are not American currency, even using credit cards that are not American credit cards. And this, I think, poses a very important danger to U.S. hegemony. And this, I would also say, amongst what the United States says are their closest allies in this latest provocation in the South China Sea, such as Japan and South Korea. Well, I saw millions of people demonstrating in South Korea against this type of militarization, and perhaps other countries as well. So the United States will not have it that easy, or not as easy, they think, to keep this coalition going against China, as they are, to a certain extent, much less extent, not able to really solidify all of the European countries behind the American pressures against NATO, if not the governments. Millions of people are demonstrating throughout Europe to get Europe out of NATO and stop American NATO arming of the Nazi regime in Ukraine. So there's a lot of things in play. Many things could come up in the next while. I will not be surprised if the United States may have some problem keeping control over South Korea and Japan.
Well, there's got to be something that needs to happen, because we're looking at how North Korea has conducted all these missile tests, Mike Billensing. At this point, do you think that the U.S. and its allies there are going to just have a wait-and-see type approach, or are they going to actually... I mean, what is the... it's confusing what strategy the U.S. is really using when it comes to North Korea. I mean, you had Jake Sullivan say that, well, the North Korean nuclear test would be a flagrant violation, were it to happen, of multiple U.S. Security Council resolutions. I mean, is that the best that the U.S. can do when it comes to North Korea?
I don't think anyone in the Biden government has any actual plan that has some positive outcome.
Okay, it looks like we may have lost. I'll ask that question from you. I'm sorry we just lost you there, Mark Billington, if you have us. Arnold August, same question to you in less than a minute, please.
Yeah. What, can you just repeat it rapidly?
Yeah, the U.S. approach towards North Korea. Are they going to wait and see what North Korea is going to do? Or are they going to lay out something that shows some logic behind anything that has to deal with North Korea?
I don't think the Biden administration has any plans at all with regards to that area of the world, aside from the long-term goal to destabilize China and eventually try to control it. So I don't think they have a plan. But they are forced to have a plan now, because the Koreans were courageous enough to respond to those drills right around their territory by firing their nuclear weapons as a warning, say, look, you are not entering Korea. We are ready to defend ourselves. The United States always has in their mentality that the other countries of the South eventually will bow down ally with the United States, but that is not going to happen with Korea, and it might not even happen in North Korea. It might not even happen with what they call are their allies in the South China Sea.
Thank you for that, Arnold August, author and journalist from Montreal. Mike Billington, thank you. Asia editor of the Executive Intelligence Review from Hamilton, Virginia. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran,
hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company.
How can I get to Nasuri Castle in Kangan?
This bus is heading to Nasuri Street, where the castle is located.
I'm from South Africa. Actually, I'm interested in Iran, its history, its culture, and of course its tourist attractions.
Great. So I'll let you know when we arrived.
Thank you very much for your help.
Nasuri Historical Castle is located in Kangan County in Bushehr Province, southern Iran. This castle dates back to the Qajarid era. This monument belongs to the Nasuri family, and they built it on a high hill overlooking the Persian Gulf. The building has two inner and outer courtyards, a royal residence, and a wind catcher. The materials used in this monument include plaster and mud. 18 beautiful paintings from the renowned Iranian poet Ferdowsi's Shahnameh are carved on the west porch of the castle. This building was built by Sheikh Jabbar II, the grandfather of Sheikh Nasser Nasuri, in the early Qajar period. This castle has been registered in Iran National Heritage List.
Thank you.
Nasuri Castle. Any passenger wants to leave off?
Oh, yes. Yes, sir. We get off here.
Great.
It's for the first time you've been here?
No, it's the second time. I have been to many Iranian cities. I've been to Tehran, Isfahan, Mashhad, and this time I've traveled to Shiraz and to Bushehr.
Oh, that's great. By the way, I'm seeing the castle. Look at there.
Thank you very much for your help. You Iranians are very hospitable.
Thank you.
Mamnoon. Mutshakkiram.
So here I arrived. This castle is situated on a hill which overlooks the Persian Gulf. The gate of the castle is on the south, towards the Persian Gulf. It's a wooden gate with carvings and stud welding. Let me go inside. Wow. After the main entrance, there is a vast vestibule. And look at there. An ivan with stone columns, which have all beautiful plaster work. Oh, I love them. This ivan stretches to a chamber through wooden gates. Very beautiful. You can't believe this chamber is decorated with plaster work. On the northern part, there is a staircase which I can go up to see the second floor. Wow, these columns are unique. I can't take my eyes off them. And let me go up the stairs. I can see a big, amazing wind catcher. This wind catcher used to make the air inside cool. And I believe wind catchers are a masterpiece of Iranian architecture. Did you like the castle?
It was extraordinary. Iran is a very unique country. It's really spectacular. By the way, would you please take a photograph of me?
Yes, of course. Give me your camera, please. Ready? 1, 2, 3. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.